This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today, a chance for you to ask questions of 2nd District Congressman Joe Courtney. We'll be talking about Electric Boat being named prime contractor for a new fleet of submarines and what that might mean for jobs in his district. You can join the conversation 860-275-7266. You can comment on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. We're also joined today by the cameras of CTN, the Connecticut Network. Representative Joe Courtney, welcome back to our program. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for the invitation, John. Good to be back.
We will be talking submarines in just a little bit, and there's a lot of other issues, of course, in your district to get to, but we really want to start with the heroin epidemic that has taken root around Connecticut, certainly. It's all over the Northeast and across New England. But it seems as though, from the stories we've heard, your district has been hit especially hard. Before we get into some specific policy stuff, maybe you can tell us what you've been seeing as you've been talking to constituents recently. What's happening with heroin in the 2nd District?
Well, as you correctly note, in 2016, which was on the heels of a pretty horrific year in 2015, there really has been this pretty scary spike in emergency room admissions at hospitals like Lawrence Memorial, and the heroic efforts that the staff there has done, but also law enforcement, who are now becoming very proficient at using Narcan, has thankfully saved a number of lives, but unfortunately, in some instances, they haven't. And there's a lot of things that are coming together that are national trends. Again, there were 28,000 lives lost in 2014, according to the CDC, which is the last sort of annual statistics that we have. We know 2015's numbers, sadly, are going to be higher. And again, we're off to a terrible start in 2016. So,
and I just want to jump in and say 28,000, and that gets us to near car crashes, that gets us to near
absolutely
gun deaths. I mean, that's in the same ballpark as things that have killed an awful lot of Americans for a long period of time. And this is a bad trend we're seeing.
It is. And I mean, it's actually, they're starting to make some data that shows that it's actually affecting life expectancy in this country, which is, that's about as chilling a data point that you could ever get. So, I think the good news is that, in Eastern Connecticut, there's been an incredible sort of grassroots effort by folks to really come together and really look at all aspects of this problem. There, part of it's law enforcement and the police departments, particularly in New London County and southeastern Connecticut, have created a regional task force where they literally start every day with a sort of crosstown briefing in terms of activity that's going on out in the streets there. And if you follow the news down there in the police log, I mean, you actually see they've made some pretty significant arrests of high volume dealers, which, again, I think nobody has any sympathy for folks who are exploiting this situation. The other thing, though, that's interesting with law enforcement, as far as, many of the cases that they see coming through, their police stations, they are very loud and clear that you can't arrest your way out of this problem. Pathway that people find themselves addicted to heroin, really has to be viewed in many respects as a public health challenge as opposed to just a criminal issue. And again, the leadership of the police it's quite striking to me, how open and strong they are about that. Families are coming out and talking about this. Again, this is something that I think, 10 or 15, 20 years ago, heroin addiction was something that was really in the shadows and something that people found, to be embarrassing or something they didn't want to talk about. But people are coming forward. Healthcare providers, we had a meeting in Norwich about the fact that one of the largest primary care systems, United Community and Family Services, are now totally reexamining their system and protocols for prescribing opioid painkillers, and they've actually reduced the numbers in terms of what's going through their pharmacy system. And so there's a lot that's happening there that I think is quite impressive, encouraging. School systems are really I think ramping up prevention and education programs in the schools. And again, not that you're seeing opioid addiction happening at the high school level, but frankly, kids who show a proclivity towards using alcohol or marijuana at a young age. I mean, the numbers are pretty clear that, you know, that's the population that later on becomes much more at risk. So there's a lot that's happening. But frankly, this is a national issue that I think really should be put on par with a natural disaster or some type of public health emergency. And unfortunately, my colleagues in Congress have not been as swift and responsive to what I think is just so obvious to so many people in this country
It
needs that help.
Well, I want to get to some of what you think the federal government can do, and I know that the president has been outspoken about this. But you know, taking your district, for example, as a national trend, it is happening, but we wonder why we've seen so many cases in your part of the world. I guess one question is, what do you know about the increase seemingly in eastern Connecticut versus some other parts of the state? Secondly, what do we know about the pathways that drugs have carried? I mean, many, many years ago, when the town of Willimantic made the front page of the Hartford Courant as heroin town, something that was kind of devastating for that community, but it was dealing with some real problems. Part of the story was that this was a pipeline. This was part of a route in which drugs were carried. And so heroin made its way to Willimantic, and it wouldn't make its way to other places. Do we see some sort of a pathway that shows us why we would be having so many drug deaths and so many overdoses in and around this 95 corridor and up through eastern Connecticut?
So, I mean, actually, if you talk to the folks at the Office of Chief Medical Examiner who looked at the 2015 numbers, which, again, showed about a 20% increase in Connecticut, they actually do indicate that it really is pretty much spread across the state. So I feel like to some degree we can go a little overboard in terms of just saying that this is a 395 corridor issue. Having said that, you know, if you look around the region, New Hampshire has the highest per capita numbers in terms of overdoses. I mean, it became an issue in the primary for people running for president. You know, Cape Cod was the subject of an HBO documentary, which is a pretty hard film to watch. But the fact is that there's just no question that sort of strip from Long Island Sound all the way north is a place that we're seeing a lot of activity out there. I mean, I think what I think is a lot of folks have, identified is why we're seeing such extreme incidents is that the heroin that's out there on the street is laced with fentanyl, which is a cheap way to sort of make more money if you're selling this stuff. And the combination is incredibly toxic. And that's why I think you're seeing low-priced heroin on the street. You know, the reports that we get back is, and I was at the Wyndham Chamber of Commerce the other day, is as low as $3.50 a hit. So if you're somebody who's, you know, got an addiction because of a painkiller use that may have started from a relatively benign incident, you know, like a sports injury or, you know, a car accident or, some type of surgery, and you're at a place where you feel you need that to deal with pain issues, $3.50 is a way of satisfying that craving is almost impossible to avoid as a temptation.
Well, you mentioned the one organization in your part of the state that's working to change its opioid prescription patterns. This is something that I know an awful lot of hospitals have been taking on themselves and other health clinics. It's something that's been talked about at the federal level. What do you want to see? I mean, is this something that needs to be solved at the federal level, or is this a state-by-state or a region-by-region issue where we literally just first change the way in which we prescribe opioids so that we just don't have so many people getting addicted in the first place?
So one of the, I think, you know, effective tools that are out there is the prescription monitoring program there where, again, when people are prescribed opioid prescriptions, that gets entered into a system. Connecticut has made it mandatory for a couple of years, and the folks in Hartford deserve credit for moving ahead there. But what you do here from physicians out there is that if somebody's, you know, coming in from Rhode Island or, another part of the country, you really sort of are back into the void. And the so one of the proposals that is out there that the president is pushing is a national prescription monitoring program so that, if you're a primary care doc in Hartford or Norwich and someone comes in who's in pain and comes from another part of the country, that you can actually retrieve that information. That's a pretty nuts and bolts kind of proposal that I think you know, should be easy, I think, for the country to embrace. You know, the other is just we've got to sort of get into the fundamental question about protocols for painkillers. You know, this became a criteria for hospitals to get their certification that they are addressing pain mm-hmm. as a patient issue before they leave the doors. And I mean, this is relatively recent. And I have heard that overwhelmingly is that, you know, people feel sort of trapped that if they don't prescribe, and it's such a subjective sort of you know, condition to respond to, that you're going to put yourself at risk in terms of licensing and certification. So the Community Addiction and Recovery Act, CARA, which passed in the Senate and, you know, was a good, I think, unfunded, but, you know, good faith effort to try and at least deal with some of the reform issues surrounding this issue, this problem. Actually is calling for a whole sort of new look at protocols. And it brings in aspects of the federal government that directly delivers health care, whether it's the VA, military health care system, but also, you know, FDA, HHS, and others. And I think, you know, that conversation and that process really has to happen. What I think the more advanced thinkers are, or people looking at this problem is that, you know, our system really doesn't get to the. So if you have a knee injury mm-hmm. and you're complaining about pain, I mean, an opioid, particularly in the immediate aftermath of a surgery, is totally appropriate and for relatively, you know, brief periods of time. But at the end of the day, if you want to eliminate pain for in the wake of an event like that, you've really got to go to the knee, not to the brain, which is where opioid really aim their therapy in terms of dealing with pain. And you know, that kind of takes a more holistic, I guess you'd say, response in terms of healthcare and how we deal with pain as an issue.
But how much of it do you think needs to be? I mean, there's sort of carrots and sticks in the way that you change behavior. I mean, one thing would be to pass laws that would say you just have to prescribe differently. Like, you can't prescribe more than 7 days worth of a certain opioid unless it's certain. And this is the sorts of things that are being talked about. Then there are other ways in which we just say, let's educate more doctors, let's educate more patients, let's just try to change it a little bit over time. If this is indeed the epidemic that we see it is, and it should be treated in the way that we're treating other terrible epidemics in our communities, does this require a hard-hitting, you know, effort in which we just change medical policy and say you can't prescribe any more than so many of these things because we're worried about them getting out in the streets and people who take them legally getting addicted?
So we had the White House Drug Policy Director come to New London a few weeks ago, Michael Botticelli, who has been in this for 30 years. And, you know, I think, you know, his command of the issue as a recovering addict himself, mm-hmm. I think, is just, you know, totally solid. And his approach, his attitude is it's an all hands on deck. I mean, this is a complex problem, you know, that requires, again, law enforcement, prevention and education, treatment, but also reform of, you know, how we treat pain as a society. But I think the you know, Washington and Hartford sometimes can overreact in terms of dealings with issues. And I think we should listen to people who, you know, really understand this with the urgency, though, that, you know, we can't keep going like we're going. I mean, as you point out, the CDC, you know, figures just really show that this does require more than just a, you know, a blue ribbon commission that's going to report back 2 years from now. And again, I think there's some really low-hanging fruit that's out there that we can deal with this. I mean, lastly, I would just say that, you know, the president's budget came out with $1.1 billion to deal with these sort of four aspects of the issue. That's a 2017 budget. We're in the middle of, you know, the house is on fire here in 2016.
And Senator, that's $1.1 billion with a B. That's for, right, the whole country.
Correct. And so... And again, that's assuming Congress passes a budget for 2017, which I think, you know, a lot of the handicappers are pretty skeptical of in the waning days of an administration. A lot of us would like to move that up and have this treated, again, like a disaster declaration. Again, we're talking about a possible Zika virus emergency supplemental appropriation. We did it for Ebola. Again, if you compare the number of folks that have been, you know, impacted by that versus this crisis, I mean, it, frankly, this crisis dwarfs those measures. Again, not to poo-poo those issues there, but so I have a bill in the House to provide for that emergency supplemental assistance, and it was not made part of that Senate bill that I mentioned earlier. But the external pressure, I think, is going to continue to grow, and this does not affect just Democratic districts. I mean, this hits rural America, suburban America, red America, as well as blue America.
Well, and we're talking with Joe Courtney, 2nd District Congressman. We're talking about the heroin epidemic, the opioid epidemic across America that's hit hard in Connecticut and in his district. We're going to talk about this for another couple minutes before we break and talk about some of the other issues that are facing him right now. I guess I should say there's two things I wanted to get to. You mentioned law enforcement earlier and changes there. This is one thing that's really interesting. Of course, we're seemingly in this new mode that a lot of people have applauded. It's taken root here in Connecticut, and everything from a second chance society to a new way in which we take a look at low-level drug offenses like marijuana possession. Cops these days are looking at users differently. But at the same time, as you said, they have to do a really good job of getting the dealers who are bringing stuff into the areas. Then at the same time, you need people who are out there using to feel confident that when they call local police because my friend is overdosing, that we're not going to get arrested, that we're going to get some help. So from your seat as a congressman, it's hard to say what exactly we can do. But how do you see these things coming together so that law enforcement has the tools and also the trust of the people so that they'll start to get the help that they need?
I mean, and that's really where we get to the resources issue, which I was just talking about, because the fact of the matter is that, you know, if you've got someone in lockup in Norwich or Torrington and you, you know, are trying to help them and make them feel that they have trust and you don't have a detox bed and you don't have any real prospect for a treatment bed, you know, you're really it makes that very hard. And that's really where I think the sort of shift in approach that a lot of the law enforcement has about the fact that they understand that these resources makes their job more successful. And as I said, that's where I think if you look at my bill, which has been endorsed by the International Brotherhood of Police Officers, as well as, you know, treatment advocates out there, I mean, it's a pretty extraordinary coalition that did not exist, 20 years ago in terms of how, you know, drugs were viewed as a, you know, as a public policy issue.
Let's get to a couple quick phone calls here. Sylvester is calling from Orange, Connecticut. Hello, Sylvester. You're on with Joe Courtney.
Yes. Good morning, John. Good morning, Congressman Courtney. Sylvester from the Connecticut Heroin Users Union here. Congressman Courtney, you and I sat together at a meeting that was held over there at the hospital in London about a month ago.
Yeah, I remember.
And yes. Anyway, thank you for being on the statewide program. Again, my question repeatedly is, I am a veteran of the war on drugs as a naval intelligence officer, and the approach from a law enforcement judicial branch side, I guess, is not working. I don't know. Well, this is my proposal to you as somebody who's at the federal level. Why not carve out for your specific district a drug tolerant zone concept where we don't turn police officers into social workers, but just basically put this entire problem and crisis in the hands of public health officials strictly? And allow, let's say, the heroin users to be able to come out of the shadows and join something like the Connecticut Heroin Users Union without fear of prosecution and all the other complicated legal entanglements.
And Sylvester, thank you for that. I want to get Joe Courtney's response.
Well,
I just think
the notion that carve-outs are something that that you can create overnight or with the drop of a hat is, in my opinion, not the best approach in terms of trying to change public policy. I mean, the good news is, and I respect, the caller greatly. I mean, he was very eloquent when he spoke to Director Botticelli, is that the fact is that the ground is shifting in the direction that he's describing. And in terms of, a change in approach and attitude, by law enforcement about how you deal with folks who are arrested such as this. But the notion that – I mean, we're struggling right now still to overcome the stigma of drug use in Washington to get this as a public health measure in terms of emergency funding. And you know, that is still the fundamental, in my opinion – obstacle towards really moving the country forward is that there is still resistance out there about whether or not these are just, you know, bad people, weak people. They don't deserve to be, you know, treated like folks, you know, who need medical and public health care. But we're making progress, partly because of, you know, Sylvester's efforts, but also because families are coming out of the shadows and really talking about this. And I, you know, I'm actually an optimist. If you look at the sentencing reform effort that's happening in Washington, I mean, that may be a real sleeper success towards the end of the Obama administration. There's been meetings with some of the most staunch Republicans, Trey Gowdy, mm-hmm. the chairman of the Benghazi Commission, but a former U.S. attorney in South Carolina has been actively meeting with folks at the White House about changing the sentencing guidelines that, again, were the most sort of out of touch mechanism that for you know, how to deal with this problem. But, you know, we still that's still the law in this country. And to get that to move, you know, by itself is a huge sea change.
Let's get to one more quick phone call. Annette from Darien. Hello, Annette.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I'm a stay-at-home mom in Darien, and three times in the last year, family members have had minor outpatient procedures and have been given prescriptions for oxycodone. And we've tried to refuse it, and they push it on us and say, you need it just in case. And we haven't gotten them filled, or if we have, we don't use it, so now I have to dispose of it. And I just think it's completely unnecessary. It bothers me. I don't want it in my house. And, you know, my son just got one, and he's been fine on Motrin.
First of all, Annette, thank you for sharing that story. And we've heard this story. Our reporter, Patrick Scale, has been doing a series of stories about this. People are overprescribed this stuff. They don't know what to do with it afterward. There's not a comprehensive solution for how to dispose of it. Many people, including another caller I'm not going to have time to get to on this, is saying, look, why are doctors pushing this stuff? Does it have anything to do with drug companies that make this stuff? And I guess I'm wondering, from where you sit in Washington, this is something that goes beyond the level of being able to tackle it in Darien or New London or any place else. And is there something that has to be done about the pharmaceutical industry pushing these painkillers over and over again when it's clear that a lot of people don't need as many as they're getting prescribed?
So there was an actual lawsuit brought by the Attorney General from Kentucky against Purdue Pharma. Because of the marketing practices that they were using in terms of painkillers. And actually, they were successful in obtaining a huge judgment against Purdue. And so absolutely, yes. I mean, that's part of this sort of protocol change that needs to happen there is that, you know, the marketing and incentives that are built into the system for overprescribing, which I think exists. I mean, I don't think anyone can deny that, has to be changed. And that means maybe, you know, a little bit more of a challenging political obstacle. But again, the story that we just heard is, you know, I've heard it as well. By the way, Walgreens has set up a drug disposal system voluntarily, and I give them credit for doing that. But that law that I mentioned or the bill that I mentioned that came through the Senate, one of the pieces of it is about trying to create a national drug disposal system to get this stuff out of people's medicine cabinets.
You know, it's interesting. One of the reasons it's difficult politically to change anything having to do with the pharmaceutical industry is because we know the pharmaceutical industry gives so much money to members of Congress to run the reelection campaigns. I guess a lot of people wonder why it doesn't ever flow the other way. Why, and something like this, where Republicans and Democrats both see the issue and they both take money from the pharmaceutical industry, why we can't have some sort of a reverse process in which enough of a critical mass of Congress says, you know what, guys, we're going to change. It doesn't matter how many millions of dollars you've given us for our reelection campaigns. We're going to force you to do something now because we have the power here. We were elected. You weren't.
Well, again, the bill that passed the Senate was 94-1. Mm-hmm. And again, it's getting into their wheelhouse in terms of really, you know, having FDA and others get into the question of how this overprescribing is happening. So, you know, that does show that the power of this issue is going to force even vested interests like that to have to yield. And again, it's there's just no excuse for creating financial incentives for stuff that really has the same chemistry as heroin. Mm.
Joe Courtney is Connecticut's 2nd Congressional District Congressman. He's joining us today to answer some of your questions. We spent a long time talking about the heroin epidemic. Obviously, we'll be able to get to more of those issues as well. But we want to turn to submarines, of course, one of the biggest issues in his district. Good news for Electric Boat over the course of this last week. We'll find out what that might mean for jobs in his district. 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live if you want to join us. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today our guest is Representative Joe Courtney. He represents Connecticut's 2nd Congressional District in Congress in Washington, but he's back home in the district. Joined us in our Hartford studios today. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. We're going to turn to some economic issues, including this announcement out of the 2nd District, the Navy announcing that Electric Boat would be the main contractor on a new fleet of submarines. Good news for the submarine building industry. What can you tell us about the details of this, Joe Courtney?
So the fleet, which is called the Ohio Replacement Program, is 12 subs that are large. I mean, these are 600-foot-long submarines that are going to be replacing the aging-out prior Ohio fleet, which was built back in the 1980s. And the if you want to sort of put it into the framework of the workload, I mean, today EB is building the Virginia-class submarines, which are the attack subs that are about 300 feet long. The workload difference in terms of the Ohio versus the Virginia is about 2.5 times. And we're at a point right now where EB's workforce is roughly about 14,000 between the Connecticut facilities and Quonset Point. The projection from the CEO of Electric Boat, Jeff Geiger, about 2 or 3 weeks ago, is that the workforce is going to grow from 14,000 to 18,000 between now and 2020. This hiring is actually having now a real impact in terms of the Connecticut labor market. The Department of Labor came out with their February statistics last week, actually, and the comment there was that the smaller Norwich, New London labor market would is now suddenly leads in annual percentage gains. In other words, they added about 3,200 jobs last year, and it was partly Tanger Mall, which is about 900 jobs mm-hmm. that is part of Foxwoods, and shipbuilding. And these are jobs that are metal trades, design, engineering. They're the kind of jobs that people can actually build a future around. There was a hiring event at EB a week ago last Saturday. They had about 160 people there. They made 148 job offers on the spot, and 95 people accepted. I mean, this is a process that's going to continue to happen. This is not a one-year blip. The production schedule for Ohio is going to go well into the 2020s.
Does this announcement somewhat further inoculate your region from some of the worries that you've had about the submarine industry that have come over the years, whether or not the sub base is going to get closed by a military commission, whether or not Electric Boat is going to move jobs elsewhere? Does this seem to you that this is not just good news for now, but maybe good news on the jobs front for quite some time to come?
Yeah, I mean, this is going to be a pillar in the region. And by the way, there's about 500 suppliers in the state of Connecticut that feed into the program. Actually, John Larson's district has the largest dollar volume in terms of work that goes into Groton. And as I said, this because of the shipbuilding plan that the Navy has put out. Again, this is not a short-term impact. This is going to be there for a long time. And if you were down yesterday, I was down with the Boilermakers in Groton and was talking to one of the more wizened guys that have been there, you know, through the downturn that took place. And he said, you know, it's just amazing how, you know, you're looking at a workforce now that is all young. And, you know, the challenge is really whether or not we're going to have the workforce, we're going to meet the workforce demand over the next 5 or 10 years. So the Eastern Connecticut Workforce Investment Board, which is the vehicle that federal funds from the U.S. Department of Labor flows through, they got a $6 million grant, which our office helped them with. They are now starting sheet metal classes, electrician classes at the tech schools and at the community colleges. I'm very bullish myself. I think that, you know, the workforce is going to be there, but it's, you know, we're in a situation right now where there was virtually no apprenticeship programs for well over a decade. You know, these programs in terms of advanced manufacturing had pretty much disappeared in the tech school environment, and now they are ramping up at full speed.
And so you feel like we are going to be getting the graduates that have the requisite skills. It's something we've heard for a long time, and not just in this industry, but in a lot of technical industries, that Connecticut was just not turning out the graduates that we needed to stay here and take these jobs. You think it's turning a corner?
And that's the purpose of this grant, the Manufacturing Pipeline Grant, is to, again, just go in. We've got some great tech schools, you know, Grasso Tech and Wyndham Tech and Ellis Tech. And, I mean, that's where this program is starting at the earliest level, because they want to really get people's mind frame into the belief that this is really where job security is. And, you know, I think they have a full complement in terms of the first classes that they're enrolling. We checked with John Beauregard, who's the director down there yesterday. And, I think we're going to do just fine in terms of meeting those workforce demands.
And, again, if you have questions for Joe Courtney, 860-275-7266.
By the way, on the design side, yeah. The University of Connecticut School of Engineering, they hired roughly about 100 kids out of the last year's graduating class. They would have hired more. Susan Herbst actually, for the first time, visited EB and had a great stop there and met with some of the interns from the School of Engineering. And so these are kids who are getting educated here in Connecticut, and then they're going to stay in Connecticut, which I know is a common refrain, which is that, you know, all our young people are heading for the exits. You know, these are jobs that are going to keep our kids here in the state. And, in fact, they're going to bring in young people from other parts of the country.
So this gets us into the part of the conversation that you and I always have. It's a fun conversation for me, but I think it's an important one. And it's actually highlighted a little bit by a conversation I had yesterday with Ralph Nader. I was visiting with him in his hometown of Winsted. And it's something that obviously not just Ralph Nader is saying, but we're hearing an awful lot on the campaign trail from both Republicans and Democrats, I might add, who are running for president. It's that the world is a dangerous place, and we need to be safe from all the various dangers. And I think it's fair to say that, you know, not too many years ago, you and I may have had a conversation about whether or not a strong nuclear submarine fleet makes a ton of sense before an emergent Russia and before North Korea is launching nukes into the sea. That all said, I think good arguments can be made for that. But earlier, we talked about the president saying that there's essentially a national health emergency around heroin abuse and opioid abuse, and we're putting $1.1 billion into it. I mean, how expensive is it to run a submarine fleet? And I guess, you know, Ralph Nader's point, the point I'll ask you about is, are we tipping once again so much toward military spending in America that it keeps us from addressing an epidemic like opioids, addressing a crumbling infrastructure that we have, addressing a massive deficit in public transportation that clearly affects your district at least as much as job losses? How do we balance these two things, Joe Courtney, and how do we have a discussion about it that's really clear-eyed when so many jobs are at stake,
right. But
we clearly have these other needs and things to spend? $1.1 billion for an entire country to spend on opioid addiction, if it's a problem, my goodness, that's a couple days' worth of building subs.
So the it's actually not, you know, it takes a little more than that. But anyway, so first of all, the question is, you know, I would argue when we talk about this decision to build this fleet and to recapitalize the Virginia class program is really almost do you want to have a Navy? Because really, if you look over time, I mean, at the end of the Cold War, the U.S. Navy consisted of 600 ships. Today, we're down to 272. The Virginia class program, which is what's, you know, the subs that are being built today, and Michelle Obama came for the Illinois at two a year, is really to mitigate a continuing decline in the size of the attack subs that are part of America's fleet. They're down to about 54. They were 100 at the end of the Cold War. They're going to continue to dip down into the 40s through the 2020s. And, you know, as you point out, you know, the world has kind of surprised, you know, intelligence analysts, military planners. You know, Putin is recapitalizing his Navy that, you know, Admiral Stavridis, who's the dean of the Fletcher School up at Tufts, where I graduated from, testified not too long ago, who basically estimates that the submarine activity by the Russian Navy is about 70 to 80% of what it was in the Cold War. China's militarizing the South China Sea in a way that it's totally flagrantly violating international law. And when you listen to the folks who are in charge of these regions, whether it's Admiral Harris, who's in charge of Pacific Command, or General Breedlove, who's in charge of the European Command, they are both and they testified in successive days before the Armed Services Committee that they need more submarines. And I mean, that is the one part of the chessboard that they identified as where we have a critical need. And, the top line of military spending, just to address Ralph's concern, is not skyrocketing upward. I mean, not every part of the shipbuilding plan, not every part of the overall pie chart for the Pentagon is growing the way that the investment—
It doesn't have to grow very much to be an enormous amount of the expenditure of the American government.
But as a percentage of GDP, yeah. I mean, we're below 4% in terms of military spending. You know, when Dwight Eisenhower made his famous remarks about the military-industrial complex, I mean, it was between 5 and 10% of GDP during the 1950s and early 1960s.
We just come out of a war. I mean, no, it was a different time.
But,
yeah.
But still going into the 60s, it was about double really where we are today right now. So, from my standpoint, historically, as far as where the defense budget is versus non-defense, it is still a smaller percentage than it was in past years when we did build highways and we did, I think, invest in education. And so I think that, this is not mission impossible in terms of trying to balance these competing needs. Well, and we need a Navy. I mean, that's, at the end of the day, we need a Navy.
Well, yeah, and I guess part of it is when you think about the ways in which Congress is unable to work together, making sure that we have money for defense spending is something that people can work on across the aisle. There's many, many congressmen like you, Democrats, right, in districts that have heavy military concentrations in which you really need to make sure that these things happen, not just for jobs, because as you said, you believe in a strong Navy. But again, we seem to always be able to make the handshake on how we can fund the military, which is why, if nothing else, it stays flat at this enormous amount of the GDP compared to our ability to react quickly, to change drug policy, to do something about infrastructure. We can't seem to ever shake hands on that stuff, and that's the stuff that's like killing people on a daily basis.
So, I mean, if you go back to last December, we did pass the Bipartisan Budget Act, which did lift sequestration caps for both defense and non-defense. And as a result, we actually got a halfway intelligent No Child Left Behind rewrite that boosted funding for Title I, which helps needy school districts. We did pass a surface transportation bill, a five-year surface transportation bill, which for Connecticut means about a 10% increase in federal dollars coming in for roads and bridges. And
we can find our own money to match it.
No, and that's, I'm in enough bar fights.
But
that's obviously the challenge of the day. But there really was a brief burst of working together on domestic priorities as well as defense. But in many respects, this is what's on the ballot for the fall. But I really think for folks to sort of, highlight this as a fight between defense and non-defense, really, I think, misses the point in terms of where I think the real, issue is. And that's really about, the burden of tax policy and the shift that took place with the Bush tax cuts, which we have still not recovered from. And I frankly think both candidates running on the Democratic side get that and I think would allow this country to address its priorities in a balanced way, unlike the other side.
We're talking with Joe Courtney. We're going to take a break. There's a lot more to talk about. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on Monday's show, we're actually going to be presenting a special from Intelligence Squared. Protests have broken out on college campuses across the country in response to what they see as racist and sexist environments. Critics of these protesters say the demands have resulted in the loss of academic freedom. We're going to broadcast this debate from Intelligence Squared that happened at Yale University. That's Monday's Where We Live. I hope you can join us. Today we're talking with Representative Joe Courtney, who represents the 2nd Congressional District. We've been talking about opioids, and we've been talking about submarines. There's a lot more to talk about. Quickly, I want to ask you, it's almost a caricature of the second district that there's so many jobs tied up in the casinos and submarines. We know that's not entirely true, right, but it is fair to say those are two very big industries. You said we added a lot of jobs in the second district because of the new Tanger Mall at Foxwoods. What do you make of Connecticut's push to get a third tribal casino, one that would be located somewhere between Hartford and Springfield to try to keep people from going to this new MGM casino? What do you make of that, and how do you think it would impact what's happening in your district?
So, I mean, obviously, for 20-plus years, the casinos in Connecticut kind of operated in a monopoly situation. And, you know, that time has come to an end. And so I think the leadership of both tribes are, you know, being much more sort of strategic and tactical in terms of how they preserve market share. And you know, this obviously is, you know, an initiative that they're pushing with the state legislature. I, you know, mentioned Tanger earlier because I actually think that, you know, at the end of the day, the best way to really solidify their position is to really improve both casinos as destination spots for a broader range of visitors than just folks who want to gamble. And I think if you look at Las Vegas, you know, that's really been the secret of the success out there is that they've made it more of a family sort of destination for many of the sites that are out there. And so Tanger is sort of part of that trend in terms of trying to make it now a shopping experience. I think that if you look at a lot of the entertainment acts that are coming in, you know, they're really top shelf that are now performing there. And I think, you know, to me, I don't think we're Atlantic City. I don't think Southeastern Connecticut is going to be Atlantic City. They're not going to close, or, you know, but they clearly, it's a new world. And that's why I think that, you know, job loss that really came on top of the recession, you know, hit New London County so hard is that that adjustment is happening there. But I do think that it's stabilized in terms of, you know, where the workforce is right now. But at the end of the day, you know, the notion that you can just sort of, you know, sit back and wait for the crowds to come in because they had no place else to go, that those days are over, and they've got to give other people other reasons to come.
So do you support the idea of building this other casino that seemingly would drain a little bit of business from Southeastern Connecticut casinos? They wouldn't necessarily be investing in making them these destinations. I mean, do you think it's a decent idea? Do you think it's a bad idea?
You know, I think it's an idea that deserves the really smartest analysis because, you know, when you make a commitment for facilities like this, I mean, it has an impact in terms of the host towns and they don't – it's not something you can kind of turn the light on and off quickly. So I get it, what the thinking is behind it, and I think that clearly it's an attempt to try and stop the folks up in Springfield from sort of siphoning off people in Connecticut. But I think it's clearly a decision that the legislature and the governor are going to have to really think through long and hard in terms of, you know, where is the right place and really what is the scope of it.
One of the things that came up this week, of course, the International Nuclear Summit happening in the wake of the Brussels attack, there's been a lot of worries about nuclear security, not necessarily about somebody being able to launch nuclear weaponry like the ones on the submarines down there, but the threats of dirty bombs, people getting their hands on this sort of material. What can you tell us about the security in your district of some of the nuclear facilities, which include a power plant and a whole bunch of nuclear submarines?
So, again, we don't store warheads in Connecticut. Again, these are vessels that are built and operated with nuclear power plants and relatively small ones. If you're looking at a Virginia-class submarine, the Ohio, when it does come online, will be somewhat bigger. What I would just say is that, you know, Electric Boat is a nuclear – there's only two nuclear certified shipyards in America, EB in Groton and Newport News, Huntington Ingalls. And they have operated since the days of Hyman Rickover in the 1950s. They have never had, you know, a problem or an incident because you can't get in and out of there. And I think you know that, John. I mean, that is not a place that you can just sort of walk in off the street. You can't even take pictures out there. So I think the security system they have there is incredibly solid. And then within the yard, I mean, that piece of it in terms of the propulsion plant is even more, off limits and highly protected. Millstone, again, after 9/11, the world completely changed there. I've been there a number of times. Getting into the property is extremely arduous. And I mean, they know me down there, but I've got to jump through the hoops. And frankly, I have no problem with that. I'm glad they do it. And the dry cask storage that they have there, I mean, if anyone tried to somehow, take dirty material off the site there, I mean, good luck. I mean, because you would need a crane and a heavy equipment to even, attempt to think about it. And, the other site is Connecticut Yankee in East Haddam. If anyone ever drives into that area there, I mean, there is a mini security force with fairly heavy weapons that guard that facility. I mean, frankly, it's time to get that stuff out of here. And I'm a co-sponsor of a bill in the House to at least set up an interim storage site that is going to have to, be there for some time before we come up with some solution to Yucca Mountain. But, this is a problem that the country really has to get its hands around. And it just seems like every administration doesn't want to touch Nevada politics.
Of the things that we think might get done in Congress during the time that you're in Congress and I'm doing radio shows, I'm not necessarily sure we solved that one.
Well, the senator from Nevada is retiring as the head of the Senate, so there may be a window there.
I have to ask you, we just have a couple minutes left. Last year, you voted for a bill to tighten the screening process for refugees coming from Syria and Iraq. If a similar bill came up in the House today, would you still support tightening these screening processes?
So I think that, clearly Homeland Security has responded to that vote in terms of, enhancing the system that's in place, which, by the way, is pretty robust right now as well. And our office has helped families from Syria, jump through those hoops. But, clearly, issues like social media searches is now, part of the new reality in the wake of San Bernardino. So if the language came up precisely the way it is right now, I would not. Having said that, I think that, no system is sacrosanct in terms of being, improved. And so I think, at the end of the day, it's important for public confidence to be there for this program, because if people feel like it doesn't work or it's not safe, then that's when you're going to have this huge overreaction with, the crazy ideas like Donald Trump about just banning people from, one of the world's largest religions entirely from coming into the country.
Since you mentioned Donald Trump, I'll just spend the last moment or two with you on this presidential race. You've come out in support of Hillary Clinton for president. Clearly, though, there are an awful lot of people in your district and all across America who said, look, Bernie Sanders is offering an alternative to Democrats. He's really talking about one or two very, very key issues, and it really has to do with changing the way that we deal with Wall Street, changing the way we deal with big corporations. I guess I'll just ask you, how much of that message is resonating with you and the people that you're talking to, even as a Hillary Clinton supporter? Is there something that Bernie Sanders has tapped into that you believe your party needs to listen to?
Absolutely. I mean, as you recall, I was the only one to vote against the bank bailout from the state. And I think that that event still burns, very deeply for many, many people, not just in the second district, but across the country. And I think he has definitely tapped into that with his, campaign's positions on it. I also think that, his advocacy to stop these trade deals that really have, I think, hemorrhaged a lot of good jobs out of the country, and her shift on TPP has been extremely healthy for the party as it moves towards the November election. So, I think if you look at my voting record in terms of some of the issues that he's talking about, I'm probably in some ways more closely aligned to him on issues of Wall Street and trade deals. I think his vote on immigration reform was a huge mistake in 2007, and that's obviously part of the decision-making process that Democrats are going to have to make between now and the Philadelphia convention.
Do you think that Hillary Clinton is hearing these messages, though? I understand that what she's talking about on the campaign trail has certainly changed, but you've known the Clintons for a long time. I mean, do you think this is actually soaking in, that she is taking to heart some of the things, those issues that Bernie Sanders has raised, the ones that you've been working on for years?
One example is also the Cadillac tax, which, as you know, was a part of the Affordable Care Act that I opposed from day one and worked with Bernie, actually, to strip from the law, and we pushed it out to 2020. Before I made my endorsement of Secretary Clinton, I mean, I had personal conversations with the campaign about the need for her to come out and support that position, and she did. And again, Bernie, to his credit, created, I think, a lot of the incentive to do that. But I do think that that's a sincere change of heart that she made.
Joe Courtney represents Connecticut's 2nd Congressional District. It's always good to see you, Congressman. Thanks so much for being
here. Thanks,
John. If you want to continue this conversation, do it online at WNPR.org/where we live. Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown produce our show with Kyone Wolf, our technical producer, Heather Brandon, our digital editor, Katie Tularski, our executive producer, Ben Esty, and Alex Ingber are our interns. Continue this conversation again at WNPR.org. Thanks to the cameras of CTN, the Connecticut Network. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.